Viking believes that a journey on the rivers of the world can be an experience designed for the thinking person. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
Learn how to plan, invest, and live smarter with the Raymond James For What It's Worth podcast. Featuring insights from leading professionals, you'll get the latest in wealth management, market commentary, and engaging research. Listen today at raymondjames.com/podcast.
I'm Jace Leigh Cobb, and you're listening to Masterpiece Studio. Following the death of her husband 18 months earlier, Widow Vivian is picking up the pieces of her life in a sun-dappled coastal retreat on the English Channel with her three charming and successful adult children who simply adore her.
Well, they moved down from London over 40 years ago now to start a family. Mum, Dad, three kids. Well, it's the perfect place for kids to grow up, isn't it?
And Vivian has a new love in her life, boyfriend Mark Keneally, a retired surgeon who also adores her. But Vivian's children suspect that Mark isn't what he appears to be. And while they're worried for their mother, each of the three siblings has their own concerns to deal with.
Oh, come on.
I'm not a project for you to manage. Sex isn't like that, and it doesn't respond to demands.
But could the twin stresses of eldest daughter Helen's work and home life really have led to her taking part in a gruesome possible murder during her mother's birthday party by the sea?
We'll be in touch regarding a more formal statement at the police station.
Formal statement?
Yes. A person is fighting for their life in hospital.
But it was an accident.
Maybe. Maybe not. If it's not, and the news from the hospital isn't good, then it's murder.
Claudie Blakely knows the truth of what happened at that birthday beach gathering, and she joins us to discuss her thrilling performance as the overworked and underappreciated Helen in Flesh and Blood, working with Robert Altman on Gosford Park, and bake-offs in the village of Cranford. And this week we are joined by Flesh and Blood star Claudie Blakely. Welcome.
Oh, nice to be here.
Flesh and Blood defies genres. It's a family drama. It's a murder mystery. It's a psychological thriller. What was it about Sarah Williams's script that attracted you to the project initially?
Yeah, I think it's about family. So it's a sort of domestic drama about a family. And I sort of found it instantly relatable, I guess. You know, I've got quite a big family myself, and it's from a big family, and then unfortunately it starts with a dead body. So immediately as an audience you're like, well, who is it? How did this person end up in the situation? And who did it? And then you think it's going in one direction, and then quite quickly it's sort of reverts to 3 months earlier, and then it becomes something else, and you follow the lives of these three siblings, and it's very interesting, and I think the characters really kind of draw you in. And I loved the script immediately because I thought it was different and I thought it was quirky, and it's got sort of two things going on which appeals to me. You know, there's a story on the surface and there's one running underneath. There's a kind of this heat sort of running underneath that you're always, as an audience member, kind of aware of. And so you're always kind of thinking of, even though it's sort of making you laugh and the characters are kind of making you laugh, you're always wondering what's going on underneath. And it has this sort of eerie quality. So yeah, that struck me and straight away, and I was in immediately.
I love the way that Helen is introduced in the script for episode one. Helen, early 40s, a designer trouser suit, pours herself a gin and tonic. Bright, organized, she doesn't mean to be bossy, just that she has a knack for seeing the best way to get things done. I mean, how does that sum up your take on Helen?
Well, I love that description. I mean, that was given to me for my audition, actually. And I think that's absolutely true with her. She's a control freak. And I think professionally, she's doing incredibly well. She's kind of soaring. She's flying professionally. And I think that she's got to take on this particular persona at work, which is very appealing to me, that you're kind of taking on this persona at work that's not necessarily how you are in your personal life, but you're taking this persona on and you're wearing this suit and you're feeling this power and you've got to get a job done. And she's very good at what she does. So unfortunately, that might translate back to her personal life. It translates in kind of a bossy way, which is not, you know, brilliantly received by her family. And unfortunately, her life is a little bit of a shambles at home, and she's sort of taken her eye off the ball. So when I read Helen, I thought, oh, this is really interesting that, you know, there's sort of two things going on. Well, there's more than two things going on, because there's her professional life, there's her personal life, her marriage is falling apart, her daughter is sort of been dragged into this horrific social media world, and which she has sort of no control over, and she's kind of losing respect. She's lost the respect from her daughter, which is really, really sad. So her home life is really sad, and then also she has this kind of sibling rivalry going on. I don't know if she's ever really got on with her brother and sister, but they're kind of thrown together because their mother, who is their anchor, who is their rock, they all love their mother so much. And unfortunately, she's now met somebody else. So it's sort of like the rug is completely pulled out from under her feet. And I think she's really sort of questioning her role in life and wondering who she is and what she's doing. And that's where we meet her. So she's pretty unstable, actually, when you first meet her.
I mean, I love the fact that she's on a train. She pours herself a pre-made gin and tonic out of a can on a commuter train after work. What does this moment on the train signify for her? Is the gin and tonic a reward or is it an escape?
I think probably initially it used to be a reward, and now it's kind of a necessity. You know, it's become her kind of like, she needs it. So it's... she's been thrown into this kind of massive responsibility at work where she's got to sort of take over this trust. And even though she's been working towards it, now that she's got it, I think it's a really frightening thing for her. And it's like a really massive responsibility. And so the drink becomes more and more of what she needs to just be able to deal with life, to be able to deal with what she's dealing with at work, which is quite frightening, I think, because she's having to let a lot of people go. She's having to make a lot of people redundant, even though she's very professional and she gets on with it and she knows the job that she has to do. I think it doesn't sit so well with her, and she needs the drink to be able to cope with it, and becomes more and more reliant on it.
That moment is juxtaposed with Mary's commentary.
So Helen is the eldest child and the cleverest. You always knew Helen would do well.
How is Helen shaped by those expectations? Is there a sense that she has to surpass her potential? Is that what she's constantly struggling against?
Yeah, I think there's a lot expected of her. It's that kind of eldest sibling thing. You know, the mother and father, they were workers, you know, they really worked hard for what they achieved. And I think that was really instilled in Helen. Maybe the other two sort of got away with it a bit more, but with her, there was a lot expected of her. But academically, I think she always did well at school. But don't get me wrong, I think she's always wanted to do what she does. And I think she loves what she does. So her heart has always been really in it, and had the support from her husband, and had a really, really lovely marriage. But there's been too much focus on her work, on her professional life, and not enough focus on her personal life. But yeah, I think a lot of pressure from her father was put on her when she was younger, but I think she thrives on it.
It's the details in her phone conversation that stand out.
Did you get something for tonight?
Yeah, I got the wine.
Didn't forget my stuff.
And the dry cleaning.
Can you take my shirt out the dryer, please? And hang it up straight away so it doesn't get creased.
Yeah, straight away.
Thanks, bye.
Okay, bye.
How important is the illusion of perfection to Helen, and what is this doing to her relationship with George, who's sort of sneaking hits of weed whenever he can?
Yeah, she's trying to hold on to perfection where she can, because I think it everything's slightly slipping through her fingers, and everything's becoming really fractured. So where she can have perfection, she will, and it's normally at home with George, and that's where it comes at, you know, sort of manifests in quite a kind of bossy perfectionist way.
We get to the inciting incident now. Helen's mum Vivian surprises all the children by bringing them over to announce that she's met someone, a boyfriend, a surgeon named Mark Keneally, who arrives at the house a minute later. How does Vivian's news shake up the structure of the family following her husband's death?
Yeah, it shakes them up so much. I think in terms of their relationship with each other, the siblings are, I would say they're not friends. They're those kind of siblings that they don't hang out, they don't socialize. The only times that they actually probably see each other is with their mother. And they kind of, within 5 minutes, they're like bickering 5-year-olds. I don't think much has changed since they were young. So their relationship is really quite juvenile and naive. And I think in terms of their childhood, I think it was pretty perfect. And they were given lovely holidays. They had the love and respect from their mum and dad. But now they're older and their private lives are sort of slightly falling apart. They hide that from each other because they don't have the kind of relationship where they can tell each other things, and they want to give the impression that everything's great and they're doing really well. And they're like that sort of swan image, if you like. They're kind of on the surface there, you know, hey, look at me. But underneath, they're all really struggling. So in terms of that, their mother is their rock and she's everything to them. And so when she's not there, they kind of have to look around them and they have to rely more on each other. And what unites them, weirdly, is their suspicion of the new man that she's brought into the fold. And they are suspicious that his intentions aren't necessarily good. And they become really protective and worried about their mother. And it kind of weirdly brings them together. I can certainly relate to that. My mum, I lost my dad when I was 26. And so she met somebody, and when she came home and told us, we were immediately suspicious, which is awful, really. But you're just very protective especially over your mother, you know. And so that's a very interesting subject, I think.
Vivian issues a rather cryptic remark about her late husband possibly being unfaithful.
Dad's only been gone a year.
It's over 18 months.
God, what do you expect? Just sit around mourning for the rest of her life?
No, that's not what I'm saying. I just think you'd be...
Dad wouldn't have minded.
Well, he's not here to say,
no,
is he?
No, we just want her to be happy.
Oh, yeah, well, we only scattered his ashes in
Jake,
March. You're saying February. Why
Dad
should I shut up?
Dad would be perfectly okay with my...
I don't care
what your father would have thought.
God, he was no angel.
Could that statement be made of any of them in this family? Despite the outward appearances, is there a sense here that no one is truly who they might seem?
I think that's excellent and that's spot on. And I wish I'd have said that. You know, that's what's so interesting about this. There's so many secrets, there's so many lies that they are all sort of slightly pretending to be somebody they're not. And but I think they're really flawed by that. I think they put their dad on a pedestal. They thought their mum and dad had this perfect marriage. And it's like, what? What do you mean your marriage wasn't perfect? It's like, no wonder I'm useless at relationships. And I think it really hits them hard to think that this relationship that they put on a pedestal was far from perfect. And the fact that they thought, oh my God, my mum suffered all this alone and didn't share any of this with us. And yeah, no, it's definitely a dysfunctional family in that respect.
I mean, considering those contentious relationships between the siblings, how do those fractured relationships compare to that between you and the actors playing your on-screen siblings, Lydia Leonard
and
Melissa Joly?
Oh, God, yeah, I couldn't stand them. Oh, no, it was, you know, we were so lucky. And I could tell in the read-through, because the way it's sort of written for the siblings is that the lines sort of, they interrupt each other. So there was always a kind of line where the next person should start there, you know, to start talking. And so there was always a sort of overlap. You know how siblings kind of finish each other's sentences? Well, that was in the script at moments, but we started just doing it like naturally and all the time. So that's a really lovely thing. And to be allowed to do that is so lovely. The director just gave us free rein just to interrupt each other, which is very rare. Not only are you lucky that other actors don't get their back up about, you know, jumping on the end of their line or whatever, it's also sound allowed us to do that, where sound normally has a real issue with that. So we kind of just, it just flowed. And I think that's really important. I think that's why it kind of looks quite real. And yeah, we sort of mucked about a lot between takes, which is a bit naughty, but I think there's that thing that then feeds really nicely into the scenes. You know, it would kind of just, action was called and we were already in that kind of lovely sort of naughty, we were quite piss-takey with each other, which worked really well. And I think that really works on screen when you've got that little glint in the eye and a little bit of naughtiness in reality, then that kind of transfers really nicely on screen. So yeah, it was a really lovely job in that respect. Yeah.
Mary is a very unusual presence in the household. I mean, she's their next door neighbor. She's a sort of surrogate mom who helped to raise the kids while Vivian was working. How would you describe Helen's relationship to Mary? What does she represent to her?
I think she's really comforting, you know. I think, you know, we've lived next door to her. She's known us all our lives. And she's always been there when mum was busy or mum, you know, because she's a working mother. If she couldn't pick us up from school or whatever, Mary would come and pick us up from school. So she's like that kind of comforting sort of auntie or babysitter that you've had all your life and that you just, you know, that you love and you have, you know, she's a rock for us, Mary. So yeah, I don't want to say too much about Mary, but to know she's always there is lovely. And even when they're older, you know, like how, you know, obviously how we meet them in the series, they all still go to Mary and lean on Mary, which is quite nice. You know, it's really comforting.
The first episode is intercut between the past and the present day, where Mary is giving a statement to the police in this first episode. It adds a framework through which the action can be viewed, but there's a sense that Mary is on the outside of the family as much as she is on the inside. Does that contradiction give Flesh and Blood a unique perspective, that these characters are sort of being seen by someone outside of themselves, perhaps with her own agenda?
Yeah, because I mean, if she wasn't there, it would just be have a very, very different quality about it. And it could be some, you know, a drama that you're comfortable watching and you kind of know that sort of genre. But Mary adds a whole nother kind of strand. And I think that's another sort of unsettling thing, because you're watching it again from another angle. And you're watching it from her angle, and she's sometimes not quite as she seems, is she? Mm-hmm. So you're wondering all the time what is this woman thinking, and why is she so interested in this family? Is it bordering on obsession? And so that it adds this other kind of oddness to the drama, and I think that's what's so special about it. And I think it just wouldn't be the same if you didn't have her. It would just be something that you've kind of maybe seen, you know, before, and this is certainly something that you've never seen before, so it's very interesting, I think.
Before this next question, a brief word from our sponsors. All Veranda Staterooms. Every day, a new view. Viking, offering a small ship experience on the world's oceans and a shore excursion in every port. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com. Coming up next on Masterpiece on PBS, Mr. Bates versus the Post Office continues Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, followed by the finale of Alice and Jack at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central. You appeared in Cranford alongside Imelda Staunton. What was it like working with Imelda on Flesh and Blood?
Oh, it was so lovely seeing her again. And yeah, I turned up at the read-through and she leapt out of her seat and ran over, and because I was so nervous. And I saw her, she gave me a big hug. And it was nice because I hadn't seen her for years. And, you know, we weren't in corsets and funny wigs and stuff. We know we got to wear normal clothes. Well, hers aren't that normal, but you know what I mean. Modern. And again, in Cranford, it was just wonderful because Cranford was just loads of naughty, naughty ladies who, you know, we used to have bring your own cake days, and we used to sit and eat loads of cakes, and, you know, they're just full of stories, and everyone was just a laugh, and, you know, nobody was precious. And so, and I, huge admirer of Imelda, and I just absolutely love what she does. I think she's such a clever, brilliant actress. So yeah, to be the scenes with her, I just loved working on. I just think she's fantastic. The way she's just utterly engaging and just pushes that boundary a little bit, you know, just quirkiness and just is utterly truthful. And I really admire her. So it was brilliant to work with her again.
There's a closeness between Helen's husband, George, and Natalie that surprised me in this first episode. What is Helen's take on their rapport? What does she see them doing?
Yeah, I think it comes down to not really knowing your sister. And if they'd sat down and had a conversation about it, she would have had nothing to fear, and it would be a jealousy thing. It would just, she would get it. But because they don't have that close relationship, I think she doesn't like it at all. I don't think seeing her sister so close to her husband is not very nice, especially when she really, really suspects her husband in the later episodes of something, you know, and she's now worried that he talks more to her sister than he does to her. And I think this is a real wake-up call for Helen. Like, hang about, should I have really took my eye off the ball here? Because my husband doesn't talk to me anymore. He talks to my sister more than he talks to me. And so I think through the episode, Helen gets a scary realization that she could lose her husband, and had really no idea that this was ever going to be a possibility, because he is a rock and he will always be there for her. But no, I think this, the thought of losing George is the scariest thought in the world.
So I want to talk about Mark Keneally. He's come onto the scene. Suddenly Vivian's in hospital. His behavior does seem insidious. He's ingratiated himself into Vivian's life really quickly, and then suddenly he's moving into the siblings' childhood home. How does Helen view Vivian and Mark's romance by the time we get to the end of the first episode?
Oh, definitely. The suspicions are starting to sort of rear their ugly head. You know, I think he started already very quickly to move the relationship in an uncomfortably fast pace that you just, that feels very unnatural. Although I would want my mum to be happy, I think Helen, as a practical human and thinking all the time of practicalities and money and the future, and, you know, she's a kind of, save your money kind of gal and be protective in that way. She's definitely got her sights set on him in terms of protecting her mother after the first episode, and then it just gets steadily worse.
At the end of the first episode, we know an incident has occurred, what Mary deems an accident, but which the police are considering a possible murder. The specifics are very much deliberately concealed, making this as much a done what as a whodunit. Does the withholding of the crime give Flesh and Blood an additional layer of mystery?
Definitely. Yeah, without a doubt, because it's the first scene and then we go back 3 months. So we are always, as an audience, wondering who that was, who did it, why has that happened? And that's always at the back of our mind. And yeah, and it definitely adds that kind of uncomfortable, kind of unnerving sort of feeling in your stomach while you're watching it. And then you go on to watch, you know, siblings argue, domestic scene, which feels quite normal. And then but how is it normal if we've just seen a body?
What can you tease about what's coming up over the next three episodes of Flesh and Blood?
Well, all I'll say is the new boyfriend makes more and more bold moves in order to win our mother's heart. And we get more and more suspicious. We get closer together as siblings, and we form a little kind of gang to find out what he's all about. So we do some digging, and it's quite interesting. And running alongside of that, we all secretly are trying to hold our own lives together, which are completely falling apart. So there's lots going on.
One of your earliest roles was as Ophelia in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead at the Royal National Theatre in 1995. Did you always want to be an actor?
I'm afraid so. Yeah, growing up, I did kind of pantomimes, and I was, I joined a little amateur dramatics because my mum used to act in the amateur group. I, as a kid, would go and play a tree or a fairy or a mouse or, I got that bug of being on stage and loved that kind of playing to an audience every night and becoming someone else. And yeah, I got that bug really early. So I was one of the lucky ones. I always knew what I wanted to do from a very early age.
Your dad, Alan Blakely, was the rhythm guitarist of the Tremolos in the 1960s and auditioned for Decca on the same day as the Beatles. Your mom, Lynn, is an actor. What did they, your parents, make of your career choice? How supportive were they of your decision?
My dad passed away quite some time ago, but I'm really, really pleased to say that he, saw me work. Yeah, he saw me do my first two jobs, one of them being Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. And funnily enough, he sat next to Tom Stoppard and elbowed him in the side and said, "That's my daughter." And so that was really sweet. And yeah, he got to see that. And I was really pleased that he did. Oh my God, my parents were fully 100 million% behind me, 100 million%. And my dad used to take me to auditions and when I was young, and yeah. And I think that having that behind me gave me the courage to do it. And I think it's a difficult profession, and so to have the support of your family and the belief of your family and the kind of, the confidence of your family that believe in you and think you've got, the ability to do it, that gives you the courage to do it. So I'm really lucky in that way, respect.
You did star in Robert Altman's star-studded, to put it mildly, 2001 film Gosford Park, as the poor, mistreated Mabel Nesbitt, who gets a very raw deal. What do you remember of this experience, particularly given the high wattage nature of the cast?
I remember all of it. I remember the first meet and greet when I was literally pooing myself. And I was just stood next to Derek Jacobi, who told me he was pooing himself. So I felt that was very reassuring because I just thought, well, how can you be worried about this? You're Derek Jacobi. So I realised quite quickly that it doesn't matter how long you've been in the biz and who you are, it's working, on the first day is scary for everybody. So that was put me at ease. And then to be encouraged, Robert Altman had a sort of makeshift screening room set up on site, like on location. And we were encouraged by him every evening after the filming to go in and watch the rushes with him.
Oh, wow.
And he would want us to, talk about it and contribute. And it was just so collaborative, and he just wanted to share all the time and talk about it, and he gave, oh my God, I mean, we were all equal, and he loved working. No offense to Americans at all, but we as Brits were just completely undemanding, and we used to just sit around and no one asked for anything. We were just all happy to be there. So he kept saying how much he loved working with us because we weren't making any demands.
Did Altman have any advice or direction for you that you sort of took to heart?
Yeah, he just came up to me in the dinner queue once and said, I think your mother died. I think your mother died when she was young, when you were young. And he just planted that seed in the dinner queue. And I just thought, God, that's brilliant. You know, just he would just feed in little kind of layers, little ideas. It's remarkable working with someone like that. Kind of never really knew where the camera was. It was, a lot of it was made up. He would just be like, oh, don't bother with the script, you know, don't bother. He loved all the accidents, you know. And, you know, when Maggie says, oh, it's a funny colour green when she looks at my dress. I mean, that was completely made up. And that's one of his favourite lines in the whole film. And just the freedom that he gave. In terms of, you know, camera, you know, you didn't have to stick with continuity, you didn't have to hit your spots or anything. And it was just a very free way of working. And yeah, he's brilliant. He was an amazing man. Lucky girl that I am to have worked with him.
One of your best love roles is as Emma Timmins in Lark Rise to Candleford, opposite Brendan Coyle, who then would go on to star as Mr. Bates in Downton Abbey. Did Lark Rise change your career or the types of roles you were being offered?
Yes, because then I started sort of getting motherly roles, which I hadn't had before. I'm one of these actors that I've sort of played, and whether it's because I was much older that having children, so I'm in my 40s now and I left it really late. And so I was always felt like a girl, weirdly, and I always played a lot younger than I was, and lucky to have played and keep that sort of going for as long as I could, I suppose. And then when I played Emma Timmins, who was of course the mother of five kids, oh my God. I had lots of babies to look after on set. It was mad. After that, yeah, I suppose I was just considered a sort of more motherly type, and I hadn't had that before. I'd always had sort of quirky, you know, quirky little naughty sort of girls. Yeah, it sort of happened overnight. It was weird, and it is amazing as soon as you play a role of that kind of high profile sort of look, then that's how you're seen.
The cast of Cranford, including Dame Judi Dench and Julia McKenzie, true or false, you guys would organize bake-offs?
Yeah, I didn't, but it was, I think, I don't, yeah, it was, I can't remember who, Deborah Finley or like Imelda, and definitely Jude. Yeah, they would all, yeah, they all thought of brilliant things to do all the time, because there were lots of days when it would be all of us. And so they would come up with ideas. And God, it was brilliant. I mean, I got really fat though. And I was wearing a corset and it was just unbearable, you know, eating all these cakes on lunch break and then having to put a corset on. It was just
quite
unbearable, but really good fun, because there were obviously days when you're in all the time and there would be like the little fates and stuff where we'd all be there but we wouldn't have much to do. So yeah, so there was a cake table permanently set up. Yes, naughty.
I mean, was that one of those sets where you have to pinch yourself because it all just feels so magical?
Yeah. Honestly, that Cranford and Lark Rise, I always really wanted to do costume drama. I always really wanted to do that, because I just thought the idea of just inhabiting a complete different era, like so different, and you know, wear these wigs and talk in this different way, and the art department, the attention to detail, you would literally be in that time. And Lark Rise to Candleford, I mean, we just filmed on this land, this farmer's land in the middle of nowhere outside Bath. I mean, it was just idyllic. With people that became my closest friends, and we all lived in Bath, and we all had dinner every night, and it was, yeah, God, it's, you do have to pinch yourself. You do. It's lucky.
Claudie Blakely, thank you so very much.
Thank you. That was great. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
If Helen is an overworked executive, her baby sister Natalie has problems of her own to sort through.
Okay, Nats. Look, be strong. I'm going to be out of there within the week. I promise you.
5 years I've been waiting for you, all right? How much longer do I have to wait until your wife kills me?
Flesh and Blood star Lydia Leonard joins us October 11th here on the podcast for more. Masterpiece Studio is hosted by me, Jace Lacob, and produced by Nick Anderson. Elisheba Etoup is our editor. Rebecca Eaton is the executive producer at large of Masterpiece. The executive producer of Masterpiece is Suzanne Simpson. Sponsors for Masterpiece on PBS are Viking Cruises, Raymond James, and the Masterpiece Trust. Masterpiece Studio is officially a Webby Awards nominee for 2024. We are honored to be considered among such talented competition, but we need your vote. Head over to vote.webbyawards.com and vote for Masterpiece Studio in the podcast section, where you'll find us listed in the general television and film category. Voting closes Thursday, April 18th, so be sure to get your vote in soon. That's vote.webbyawards.com. Thank you.